Now the upriver.
Now I just want to cite one other instance of the farmers and their struggle here in the state of Minnesota, near the city of Minneapolis, of course. And that was the one that happened at Elk River. There in 1933, I believe. But anyhow, it was the big drought year. Elk River happens to be situated in the county that has rather what we say, or is commonly known as, well-to-do farmers. That is, farms with, they're rather large, well-stocked, fine cattle, other stock of all kinds, nice houses and buildings. But when the drought came, they had nothing to eat for their stock. It was burned up. The national administration at that time had to put into effect a program to alleviate and help those in the drought-stricken areas. This was left up to the counties to decide as to whether or not their county was drought-stricken. The counties had to also contribute a certain amount to this help that the federal government was giving to buy feed and seed and other things necessary on the farmers, because they were completely wiped out. They hadn't raised anything. They had stock on their hands. And in fact, any place here in the state of Minnesota that you drove through, all you could see was see and hear was cows and cattle. It was bawling mainly for something to eat. There was nothing but parched grass and straw as far as the state here was concerned. But it so happened that in this county, or Elk River and Stearns County, I believe, is located there, they must have had very either conservative or reactionary county commissioners, because they refused to declare Stearns County in a drought-stricken territory and therefore could not receive any federal aid. See, are we sure that's Stearns? We'll have to check on that. Well, the farmers demanded in great numbers that they be declared in to the drought-stricken area, whereby they could receive some of this federal aid so that they could have food for their stock. And not only food for their stock, but also many of them had reached the state while having farms of this size and having these cattle. As I seen and talked to, many of them didn't even have anything to eat. They were not better off than many of the unemployed people had been. Therefore, after a number of meetings, demonstrations to the courthouse, the farmers decided through their organizations that there's only one thing to do, and that is to go to the courthouse, to sit down there and stay there until the county commissioners would declare this county into the drought-stricken areas and get relief. The county commissioners were very obstinate under the program of WPA. But through the organization of the Workers' Alliance, they had already in Washington forced those who were in at the head of WPA to put into the program that all skilled workers and all workers, for whatever they may be doing, be it labor or skilled work, shall be paid the minimum wage. Said they never would do this, but the farmers carried out their promise. They sit down in the courthouse, which didn't draw too much attention the first day. But when they stayed the first and the second and the third, their numbers grew. Grew till it got to be of mass proportions. But still the county commissioners refused to even meet. They refused to meet or hold a meeting as long as the farmers stayed in Elk River Courthouse. Question's been asked, how were they fed? Well, as I say, there was a lot of them that didn't have very much food. So that type of work in that locality, but it was being violated all over. The result was, as I said, like in Pine City, there it required a strike of several days and the involvement of many government officials before we were able to force the wage scale to be put at the standards that had already been decided on a national scale. There was others, as I said, in the western part of the state. Out in these outlying territories, the majority of the workers on these projects were actually farmers. They were not, because they were not industrial towns, some of them were those who, like in most of these towns in the country, they are either farmers or closely connected with the farm work. They work for farmers, or in other words, they're in the agricultural section of the economy. So you see, the farmers were supporting and involved in these mass struggles that was taking place, originally started through, they didn't have any. But some of them did still have food. And the result was, food was brought in. Yes, some arrangements was made for even cooking in there. They had electricity. There was many hot plates brought in. Coffee was made. A number of warm things was brought. Many very good meals was brought in directly and cooked right in the neighboring farming communities and brought in. There was nobody who went hungry during this demonstration. In fact, I had the opportunity of eating there a couple of times. I was asked to come to speak to the meetings. I did. And certainly I had quite an experience there. But after a period of time, which I just don't recollect how long it was, but it ran into weeks, at least more than 2 weeks. And finally, not only the demand of the state administration, the demand of many people, many organizations outside of this county began to demand that the county commissioners meet, and they meet with the representatives of the farmers for the purpose getting the relief and feed for their stock. This meeting was held, and these same county commissioners who said they would never meet until the farmers had vacated the courthouse and gone home, that is, they made no promises that they would, but they said they would meet afterwards. Farmers wouldn't take their word. They stayed. The county commissioners did meet while they were there. I happened to be there at that time. They hadn't met more than 15 minutes until they came out and announced that they had sent a communication, telegram, not even a letter. They had to make it quick. They sent a telegram to Washington stating that Stearns County was declared a drought-stricken area. The farmers got their feed, they got their seed, and in many cases got food. This very good about the farmers. Well, I promised I was only going to cite those three, but it came to mind now. I said that I would only recite those three, but I want to recite one more incident, and that happened in Aiken. Now, these situations was taking place all over the state, but mainly I am citing those in which I was at or an eyewitness to or sometimes participated in. We got a request one time for a speaker to come to Aiken. Aiken lays quite far north of here. It's not a farming community as great as the one that I mentioned about Elk River, but nevertheless, there's people up there who have attempted to dig their living out of the soil. They've cleared up the land. They went into the wilderness. They built their homes. They raised their families there. During this Depression time, people couldn't pay their taxes. And they couldn't pay their bills. Some had credit on machinery that was necessary to run their farms, but they couldn't pay. So in this territory around Aiken, I believe it's Aiken County, I'm not sure, but anyhow, we got a request to come up there to a meeting. We decided to use some of the tools that they had worked the farm with to protect their homes. And one of the best weapons that they had was the pitchfork. So they armed themselves with pitchforks at one of the attempted evictions. There was no action taking, no one was hurt, but nevertheless the threat of using the pitchforks prevented the eviction and then the arrests of those who were responsible for threatening to use the pitchfork. And this was the time that we were invited, along with numbers of other organizations that had begun to see the light and the necessity of fighting to even have a place to live in, a roof over their head. I was the one who was sent. I got there. We went to the meeting in the assembly room of the courthouse. I don't know if it was the courtroom or what, but anyhow, it was the largest room in the courthouse. I had met to not only work out further strategy, but to also protest and prevent the prosecution of anyone who participated in the preventing of the evictions. And there was one thing that happened here. Naturally, in a case of that kind, what can you do? You can only congratulate farmers or workers who will take such a position and dare to fight for their rights. And in this case, I did congratulate the farmers and told them that if that is the only means left at your disposal, then it will have to be continued if you're going to stay in your home. At that time, unbeknownst to me, the county attorney was sitting back in the audience. He arose to his feet and he says, "Say," he says, "you know, I can put you in jail for saying a thing of that kind." I says, "That may be all true. You can put me in jail, but if you leave the window open, I'll still tell the farmers not only to threaten with the pitchforks, but to use them. Now, if you want to put me in jail," but nevertheless, he didn't put me in jail. And the farmers went on and didn't back down, but instead they reaffirmed their position that they would use more pitchforks if necessary, that they were determined to stay. The outcome of that was a moratorium was declared, no further evictions took place, and most of those farmers or their families are still up there on these farms that they were going to be thrown off of in those days. Well, now we're going on a little farther here in some of the big struggles that took place here in the state of Minnesota. And among them, as far as both numbers and influence or pressure, whichever one you want to call it, stood out above all others.
We should break in, Jamie, if you have anything to add.
And that was the big unemployment insurance. Workers and farmers unemployment insurance for unemployment insurance or farm relief. Now this was supposed to be a state enacted bill. Minnesota took the lead in demanding that until the federal government had put in unemployment relief, unemployment insurance, that we would have to fight on a state scale to put it through there. And this mobilization to this Congress took place, it was on the 12th of March, 1934. This required a lot of real organization. While organizations had grown in the state, as I think I have brought out before, the workers had their unemployment councils or unemployed councils. Farmers had the Farmers Alliance, the farm holidays. There were some unions already growing, being rebuilt. And this Congress was really broadly represented. Practically every union, at least if they didn't have an officially elected delegate, they had delegates sent over to observe or even participate. It was democratic. No one was denied the right of participating in this Congress, whether he be officially elected delegate or whether he only come there of his own free will or sent there to observe. Now, how was this built? Well, first of all, it was built by contacting the leaders of all organizations and wherever possible to involve the leaders, if not leaders, to involve rank and file workers, whoever we may be able to, for the purpose of forming statewide committees. And before the Congress itself took place, this committee had grown to be over 150, and the majority of them were actually elected delegates from organizations, and a great percentage of them from the trade unions, which we could name a lot of them. The building trades was well supported, the upholsters was there, the packing house workers from Austin, Minnesota, from Faribault, and from, so many, I just can't think of them all offhanded, from Duluth, Minnesota, from organizations existing there. But anyhow, it had grown to be very broad. But then, of course, the question come up of what are we going to do to finance all of this thing? Of course, then the workers and all had to go into a lot of problems. But now, in order to get the purpose of the organization realized, we had to first speak to the officials of the state, the elected representatives, the senators, member of the House of Legislature, the governor, and others. Well, of course, they had to be approached. Logically, the first one to be approached would be the governor. He's the one who has power of calling a joint session of both houses. Well, this here wasn't easy. Many people may think it was. The committee was not the broad committee of 150 that we had, but it was what you called a resident or Twin City committee that approached the governor first on this. His answer was, no, I want nothing to do with it. It's impossible. The people won't respond. Of course, our answer to him was that we demand it be done, that we know the sentiments of the people, we know they will respond, and for him to leave it up to us to do the mobilizing. But he still disagreed. It required numbers of meetings. Finally, there was only one thing could be done, and that was to call a statewide committee. And remember, in this committee was some of the best farmer laborites, at least those who actually got out and worked for the Farmer Labor Party. Many of them precinct captains, some of them even county, in charge of the county organization. So we had to bring them in. And at that time, when we brought the big committee in, there wasn't room in the office, but we had to use the governor's reception room. Well, when he seen there those people who he had to depend on politically for a lot of the support that he had, he began to see things in a little different light. And that was that he began to think, from appearances, that he had to begin to cooperate, at least to a certain extent. Because we only had one alternative, and that was that unless a farmer labor administration led by a farmer labor governor was willing to cooperate with the workers and the farmers in the state of Minnesota in order to force, as he said, this reactionary legislature, in order to force them to take action on to help the situation, then he was not doing his duty towards the people, and therefore, in our opinion, the workers and the farmers is not going to support somebody who only does a lot of talking with no action, at least the action to the extent that he would agree to call a joint session of the House and Legislature. And at that meeting, he did agree. But trying to belittle the efforts of the organizations, that it'll just be a flop, and in this way will only hurt the cause instead of bettering. But we told him, this will be our worry. Well, then another problem came up. A lot of delegates coming in who wouldn't have a place to eat, wouldn't have any money to eat. We knew that. So therefore, the governor has a fund in which he has to account to nobody or request of nobody how he spends this. So we ask him then for help in furnishing at least some of the meals. We would furnish the housing. Well, it was a big argument. He wanted to first give $100, $200, like general bargains go. Finally getting up to 500, we were demanding 1,000 at least. Why? Not only because the money was there, couldn't be used for a better purpose, but because just prior to this, only a matter of weeks, Governor Olson had given to the Daughters of the American Revolution a very large amount, which I can't just remember just what it is at this time. The Daughters of the American Revolution. Certainly we know an organization that has never been interested in helping the condition of the workers or farmers. But nevertheless, I told him at that time that at least if you gave this to the Daughters of the American Revolution, we should have a like amount for the workers and farmers here. Finally, he agreed to give $750. But the committee said that this would not be sufficient. But I believe that he was sincere in believing that it wouldn't require more than this to feed the delegation that would be there. So he said of his own accord that, now listen, tell you what I'll do. I'll give you $750. And I will pay for all other meals that will be used by the delegates while they are here. All you have to do, I'll have meal tickets made, and anything else over that, I will make arrangements with the restaurants to send the bill to me. Well, he got quite a surprise out of that. The result was, there was 1,200 delegates. Actual delegates. The conference lasted 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, and Monday the march to the state capitol. They gave or rather I should say, the meal tickets lasted for the first day. And that was very conservative. No one was given a meal ticket who wasn't an official delegate, not just a spectator. Every credential had to be shown. The meal tickets were given out and they were gone. The delegates then had to go to the restaurant, and it's one good thing he kept his word. They had to say, charge it to Governor Olson, and they did. And the result was, I forget how much it was, but it was actually amount of hundreds and hundreds of dollars that he paid additional for this, which certainly we want to give him credit for, because the papers certainly did raise thunder about this here, him authorizing people to go eat and then the state have to pay for it. But the convention and the outcome itself, the program was worked out mainly around the issue for unemployment insurance on a state scale, and aid to the farmers, similar to the national demands, but only to be enacted on a state scale. Then the march that took place to the Capitol. Well, up until that time, and I haven't heard of anything since that was larger or more spectacular, it was the largest parade or march that ever took place in the city of St. Paul. And this can be referred to any one of the Twin City papers or anyone that wrote an account of it itself. They estimated that over 80,000 people marched. As an example, if anybody's familiar with St. Paul, the assembly ground was at the courthouse, the new courthouse, Kellogg Boulevard. From there, we walked down about two blocks towards the post office. Then up St. Peter Street and back over to, that name of that street runs right past the Capitol. But anyhow, marching eight abreast, when we got to the courthouse, we got word, to hold it up, because the people hadn't even yet, the last end of it hadn't even got started from the courthouse yet. Over 80,000 people was in this. Now there, a joint session was held. Speakers representing the building trades unions, packing house workers, the unemployed councils, some other unemployed organizations. That, like in all cases, you do find such things as so-called independent organizations or whatever they want to call them. But anyhow, they were there. And they were given the privilege of speaking before the joint session of the legislature. One interesting sidelight took place was the legislatures, a lot of them, thought, well, this will be a fine day to take off. Thinking, well, there'll be so many people around there that nobody will miss us. Result is, we'll just go out and take it easy today or do whatever they want. And they did, a lot of them. But they forgot that there might be a roll call vote made. This is one thing that I think has never been done, at least to my knowledge, any place else in the country. I was told that a lot of them had absented themselves from the sessions, and so we decided to find out how many of them are here. So we got a hold of the clerk who reads the roll call, and he gave us the roll call. And we called the roll of all of those who were present and marked it down, and also marked absent to all those who were absent. And in turn, made the statement that we will make it public throughout the state about who was absent and who was present at the legislature. Well, it was very interesting to see those guys flock back in. They didn't only flock back in during the afternoon, this was a whole day procedure, but they flocked back in even at night. And further, they even called me up at my home and trying to make an excuse while they were absent. Now, this year has a certain lesson. Why did they do this? They realized the sentiment of the people. They realized that politically it was very poor strategy to not at least listen to the demands. Even the most conservatives did this. Well, they all stayed there until it was practically night. Now it was very interesting to see how people got there. Well, in Minneapolis, which I suppose because of the mass organization, people who didn't have money for streetcar fare and tokens, they started the march from Minneapolis. And in fact, when I left, I was lucky I did have a car because I had to be over there with a party. But I had seen this march before I got over. And it was a big march. But by the time they got about to the seven corners, they began to get tired. Some of them had came clear from North Minneapolis. So the result was, as the streetcars came along, they just simply boarded them. They got on the streetcars. And when the conductor asked for their fare, they said they had no money. Of course, the policy of the streetcar company is they don't haul people for nothing. So the conductor, I suppose, trying to follow out what they would say orders would be, they just simply stopped the streetcars till these people got off. But nobody got off. The result was the streetcars began to line up there, main line to St. Paul. They couldn't move, so finally the company had to give orders to move them cars. Never mind about your fares. And the result was there was hundreds and even thousands who went over. And of course, when they got there, the same problem arose, how they're going to get home. Already the orders was given to let them ride. When they got on, said they had no money, and the result was they got back home. Well, this all required some militancy on the part of the workers. We had nine speakers altogether. We had people couldn't get inside of the Capitol at all. I don't know how many got in, but probably if you put 5,000 or 6,000 people inside, at least to where they could see anything. I know the rotundas was full, the chambers was full, every place that they could possibly get in, and I don't suppose they probably got more than 4,000 or 5,000 inside. That would be quite a bunch. But the whole yard, the whole complete thing, was just a mass of humanity in support of it. There was nine loudspeakers that were set up on the outside, on every side of the Capitol, so that they could speak. Besides, we wired out from the main microphone that was up in the chambers, that was wired out to the outside too.
How'd you do all that? I can't.
Well, it was just done. I don't know. In among them, you know, you when people are that, you got all kinds of people. You have electricians. Mm-hmm. You have radio people. You have loudspeaker people. You have everybody. All you have to do is just ask for somebody to do this. And so they'll always find ways and means of getting wires or whatever it is. Maybe it was already wired. I don't know. But anyhow, I know the speakers were going outside.
I know, I was outside.
And you see, it was just...
on the way to Washington.
Yeah. So while the delegations of the Hunger March was organized here, the Unemployed Council also had the march to the courthouse to demand the increase in relief, because when they started it, the relief didn't by any means provide any kind of a decent existence. I mean, they could just gnaw along, you may say. It just kept them alive, but it certainly was a long ways from adequate, which never did reach that point. But there no more than got to the courthouse. This is after a permit had been granted by the city for the march and the demonstration.
Was Anderson there then?
Anderson was mayor then, yes. And we got to the courthouse, went to speak, our committee went to the door and was going in to present the demands, which had all been agreed by the city, but instead of getting in, the cops blocked the doors and refused to allow them in. And then, of course, we went to speak to the workers. It was a mass, I don't know how many, but there were thousands. Instead of that, the cops made the flying wedge, and they came in and began to clubbing and arresting, and I think that they had 21 that they arrested at that time. In fact, Arthur was one of the defense attorneys on that case. And this was just another demonstration.
That wasn't the time they used tear gas. That was later.
No, that was later. I was more than Sam was in charge of that demonstration. That is, he was. Mm-hmm. No, it was mainly clubbings, taking into the jail all of those that they could, and beat up. You know, Hetry got beat up in jail. Numbers of them got beat up.
Stands out in my mind was the one that you just mentioned where Sam led the demonstration at the courthouse. Mm-hmm. And at that time we were publishing...
That was the first one I was in too. That,
yeah. That we were publishing, I think it was the United Action at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I had... we sold it for 2 or 3 cents or something like that an issue, because I know I had a handful of pennies in one hand and an armload of the papers in the other when they shot off the first tear gas bomb. And I never did know what happened to all the pennies that I had, because from that time on I was a block away from there when I came back to where I realized what was going on, because the tear gas bomb exploded right at my feet. And the thing that I remember most about that was when it was right after the Flower City strike, where they had the 2 nights of police attacks on the picket line. I think it was the second day after the last fight at the Flower City, and Sam was speaking up on the wall of the courthouse, and apparently he had seen one of the police point a gun at him, because he said, "Then you blue coat fascists," he said, "why don't you shoot me, or should I turn my back so you can shoot me in the back like you did the Flower City strikers?" And just then, they shot off the tear gas bomb, and Sam dropped down off from the wall, and I thought, sure, that Sam had been shot. But, of course, right at that time, all pandemonium broke loose, and everybody was scattering in all directions. And, of course, that dispersed the demonstration after that, as the main body of people left.
Weeping.
At that time, because naturally the air was just blue with the with the tear gas, and you couldn't see anything or even know what was going on, because it did sort of fog you up.
We had the office on Hennepin there, and everybody started coming to Hennepin with their eyes streaming, and I think Nat was here then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He wasn't here though.
He wasn't here.
Not that day. Either
well, I know at that time they still had some.
You must know a problem.
Oh, we're taking from day to grace in the woods, so he knew every tree. Killed him in the barn when he was on the tree.
Day,
from tear.
Ooh, good. Can you sing it again?
Yeah.
You have a beautiful voice. Go on.
Baby Crockett, King of
Laughter. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Don't laugh.
Go ahead, laugh. Go ahead.
Then the bridge is falling down, falling down. Then the bridge is falling down. My fair lady, filled it up with sticks and stones. sticks and stones, build it up with sticks and stones, oh, my fair lady.
Good. Your children have... Ready?
Sorry, Rupatelli Shoe, all a motor, all a motor. Sorry, Rupatelli Shoe, all a motor, dashing you. Ding dong.
Wait!
What? I go, Gabby.
Ding dong. What did I get? Another day older and deep branded. St. Peter's, I can't go. To my soul, to the company star.
My mother.
Her face is sweet and kind. Her way, her voice is soft and low. My heart is loving her all day. As round the house I go.
Well, actually, the union included lumberjacks and mill workers in the timber workers union.
And they were were they organizing the union, or was it?
Well, they had no union up there. Company owned town, where the company owned the one industry there, which was the mill, and they owned, of course, other lumber camps and so on. Mm-hmm. They owned the electric company. They owned all the houses, the stores, the taverns, the hotel, and all of the county officials. And when the woodworkers went in and started to organize them, they had a company union. And the company union applied for and got an AFL charter to make them more or less an official union, because at that time the labor board was a pretty progressive group, and company unions were just not...
Was this about 36? Was this after the Roosevelt or earlier?
Well, let's see now. It was during the Benson administration here.
Oh, it was 37.
Yeah. So after the company union had received the AFL charter, we had an election. Where, of course, there was an awful lot of skullduggery went on because of the fact that this was the company had such a stranglehold on the community. And there was a strike called by the Timber Workers Union.
Yeah.
Well, at the time that the strike was called, of course, the thing went along rather quietly for a while. But one morning, we went down on the picket line, and we were just lined up on each side of the road that led to the gate going into the mill. When the gate opened up, and out comes a whole, well, you couldn't call them anything but a mob. They were all armed with clubs and bats and everything they could get their hands on. And that was the first major battle that we had up there. And naturally, the pickets themselves had nothing but their bare hands, and consequently, the Union forces were pretty badly beaten. In fact, I went to help an elderly lady who had been hit, she said, by the chief of police, and I was helping her up to the strike headquarters when the rout took place, where the mob chased the pickets. And of course they scattered out all over. We got to the strike headquarters, and we got in there, and of course we locked the door, and there was only a handful of us in the strike headquarters, and this mob comes up after everybody else had scattered. They come up to the strike headquarters and start smashing down the door, so we took off out the back way, and I went into an outside privy and stayed there until after dark, until I could get back to where I was staying. Well, of course, during the time of all this activity going on, there was many arrests. And in fact, the entire executive board of the Union was taken to jail. And the next morning, I found out that they had a warrant out for anybody that could be identified as being on the picket line. So I spent about 3 days inside where I wasn't out around where they could serve the warrant on me. And in the meantime, of course, we had to get some semblance of organization started up again because of the fact that they were all in jail. Well, during that time too, there was threats, of course, of things that were going to happen by this mob. And in fact, one interesting point of this is that the same one that took Hank Paul out and beat him up was the leader of the mob that broke up the picket line that morning and released, and I don't know what his status was at that time.
He was a professional.
Yeah, he was. And in fact, in talking to some of the people up there, they told us something about that case too, where they said that this Kenny Allen was his name, was bragging around in the taverns of the job that he had done on Hank Paul. And he told people that he had been paid $500 for doing the job and so on. Well, he had led this mob. Of course, he wasn't the type of person who organized these things himself. He was... Well, we published a strike bulletin up there that we call the Liberator. They were all in the Timber Workers Union. Well,
was this an independent union then? Was it belong
to
the
CIO union?
Oh, it was the CIO.
Uh huh.
It was organized after the CIO.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, one of the other incidents that happened during this strike that gives you some sort of an idea of the siege of terror that was going on when all of these. All of the leadership of the union were in jail. We had heard several threats going around, and of course there were some people that had come into town from the district headquarters of the union. And we thought it would be a good idea to get our mimeograph machine and typewriter and so on out of town because they had threatened to smash it up. So we went, of course, after dark and in through the back alleys and so on, up to get the mimeograph machine and typewriter and so on. And there was five of us, I think, in the car when we started out. Naturally, we started out on the main road between there and Rhinelander, because that's where we figured it would be the only place, the closest place that would be safe, because we couldn't take it into any of the surrounding towns there, because they were all under the control of the same forces. So we started out in the car with all of this stuff packed in there, got out on the highway and got up to, I would say a couple of miles out of town, and here's a roadblock. That is, they had the sheriff's cars and so on across the highway, and you could see the sheriff and the deputies and all the rest of them out there in the road. So we couldn't go that way. So we took off and we're going
you
to circle around.
They saw you.
Mm-hmm. We turned around right in the middle of the highway and went back off in the other direction. Well, every road that we tried to take out of town was the same thing.
Did they
know
were
all
you
blocked.
Were doing this? Or that,
well,
this
they were, no, it was the idea that they wanted to make sure that nobody got out of town that they could possibly arrest on these John Doe and Jane Doe warrants that they had. So we finally ended up on a little, I suppose they were some kind of fire trails or something in through the woods. They weren't, perhaps logging roads or something like that. And we went through these little logging roads and finally got the stuff into Rhinelander. And we got in there and didn't know what to do with it, so we went to a hotel and rented a room and left the stuff in the room for a while until things quieted down again. Well, one other interesting incident there that points up the feeling of these people. I didn't know it at the time, but I found out afterwards that during this period that the lumberjacks had been sleeping on the floor outside of my door. I had gotten up a couple of times and seen them out there, but naturally, you know, you think that they're just, that that's as far as they got and they went to sleep, but I did hear later that they had intentionally slept out in front of that door. Of course, the door was broken into once. I don't know if they actually got into the place or not, because there was nothing missing. But the door jamb was all splintered up.
Did you, what was the result of it? Did they get the organization in the mail?
Yes, it was organized, and in fact, the people up there said that they lived better during that strike than they ever had before in their entire lives.
During a strike?
During a strike. We set up the commissary and went out and collected food from the farmers and merchants. There were some merchants there. There were tavern operators and a couple of stores and so on that were not under Connor's thumb. That is, to the extent where they wouldn't at least undercover give help to the
mm-hmm.
strikers. So we had these cooking in big wash boilers and so on, and people would bring their whole families down there, and they'd eat their meals. And of course, as far as their other expenses were concerned, they were all company-owned places. I mean, everything that they used belonged to the company anyhow. At least during this period, they weren't running up grocery bills. There. And of course, anybody else in the town that was employed was in the hotel or someplace like that, and it was very small amount of people employed outside of the mill. But the people that worked in the mill, many of them had never been out of this town in their entire lives. That is, they were born there and they lived that way from the time they were born. Actually, for many, many years, they never received a paycheck at all back in this community. They were all paid in company script that was only good at the company stores, and at the end of the week, all they received was usually a notice of how much they owed the company in addition to their wages, because of course the wages were very low in the first place. Most militant group of people that you ever saw in your life. And a lot of them had come from Kentucky. I suppose one reason, one way to account for their...
Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. One way to account for their militancy was the fact that they had nothing to lose.
They were tired of that paternalism.
Uh-huh. There was absolutely nothing that they could lose because they had nothing in the beginning. I mean, it was just a question of, there was a chance of gaining something, but there was no chance of losing anything. They came to leave their homes and go up there to work. But I do know that the president of the union, I used to get him into conversations just to listen to him talk, because he talked with this Kentucky accent or brogue or whatever you want to call it. He was the president of the union, and he couldn't even write his own name. They were mostly completely illiterate. And a couple of instances of the president of the union that he was one of these real tall, gangly young fellows, you know, that his clothes never fit him because he was so tall and lanky, you know. His shirt sleeves would come up here and his pants like about that far from the bottom. And he got up in the union meeting one night and he got up on the floor and he says, "I want to make a revolution." As I said, I tried to get him into conversations just to listen to him talk, because he was, because of the fact that he would, he was very amusing, you know. And one other instance where I asked him about fishing, because those people up there, of course, they, in fact, they had to survive during all these years. They had to get a lot of their... Practically all the meat they got was game that they killed, and fish and things like that. So I asked him one time what they used for fishing up there, if they used rod and reel or how they fished. And he says, "Hell no, we shoot the sons of bitches." And actually, he did. He'd go out and as the fish would leap up in the air, I suppose they were trout or something, he'd leap up in the air and he'd take his shotgun and and that's the way you'd get his fish.
Mm-hmm. If you didn't shoot it right, you'd destroy a fish, I should think. You know, you'd have to shoot it just between the, on the head or something like that.
Yeah, well, I don't know how that worked out, but I know it, he actually did. And that's the way, of course, they got their deer. We had venison during the strike up there, too, because... Of course, meat was one thing that was a little bit harder to come by than the other foods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't have any trouble getting vegetables and that sort of thing from the farmers. And in fact, the women in the town, that is the wives of the strikers, baked bread by the hundreds of loaves and brought down to strike headquarters. All down on the picket line at 5 o'clock in the morning, every morning, and there was several incidents of...
What were they striking for? They, I don't understand. You want
to actually win the election until after we had left there, because during that time also, Harry had been arrested during that people's lobby, you know, and so when he was up there, they had gotten a warrant out for him to extradite him back to Minnesota, and so then...
Close the door!
So he was extradited back to Minnesota and had to serve 4 months in the workhouse for the People's Lobby demonstration.
Was he in that?
Back to Minneapolis. And after that, of course, now they have the CIOA union there. But what happened was that after they got some demands there and started getting some paychecks, everybody left.
Oh.
And of course, after that too, then the war broke out and some went in the service. But I've heard of, there's one family living here in Minneapolis now that lived up there. And they've kept me more or less informed as to where the rest of them went. And a lot of them went to bigger towns in Wisconsin, and some went to Chicago, and some went to California, and they just scattered all over.
Why did they?
Actually, they didn't have any money at all.
They had to stay.
Yeah, because everything, even when they got to the point where they paid paychecks, they owed it all to the company at the end of the week. So all they had to do was just take their paycheck and turn it back to the company. And as far as, for instance, their housing, these company-owned stores, I mean, the company-owned houses, were two-room houses, one up and one down. And, of course, there wasn't any such things as stairways or anything like that. And, in fact, you could look out, you could be in the house and look out. And this is up in northern Wisconsin where it's mighty darn cold. You could look out through any of the walls and see right outside. And the people that had big families, I know the one family there, at that time they had 6 children, they now have 14, that's the family that's living here. They had 1 bed for 8 people, and kids slept on old coats.
Your dog is outside, laying down.
They slept on old coats and things like that, and their furniture would consist. I mean, there wasn't such thing as living room furniture in any of the homes that I was in. There was
How did you stand the winter with it?
Well, I really don't know. But they'd have a kitchen table and some chairs, and of course wood-burning stoves. There was no such thing as any type
outdoor
of
plumbing, I suppose.
Oh yes. In fact, they had no water in the houses at all. They carried their water from wells and so on. And then they'd have to heat it on the stove. They washed with an old washboard. And they lived just like they did, I guess, back in the pioneer days.
Only worse.
Yeah, because there they were working for somebody else, and he was reaping all the profits while all they got was the work out of it. This company union, there was 2 young brothers. One of them, I heard later, was killed in the Second World War. But these 2 young brothers had stayed in the AFL union after the AFL gave them a charter. They had stayed in there intentionally, what they said, waiting for the ripe moment to lead a group into the CIO. That is, I suppose, they were waiting for them to actually see that the AFL union wasn't anything different than their company union. It was the same setup. And they had stayed in there to lead the group out. And the first we knew anything about it was when these 2 brothers came up to where we had our office there and told us that they had been in sympathy with the strike all the time, but they had stayed in there for that purpose. And then, of course, they became leaders in the CIO union.
Did you have any education in the strike outside of the paper?
Well, of course, we had a group that we came down here and got a lot of progressive literature and so on. And that reminds me of an amusing incident where we had this group together and we asked them what their interpretation of socialism was. And one fellow said, well, My idea is that if you have a car, you have to take off the wheels and give one wheel to each of somebody else, and you have to take this off and give it to somebody else, and so on. And after they had the theory explained to them, they all became very progressive people. And of course, it would have been a very good thing if they would have stayed there and made use of the education that they had received. In fact, many of them told us that they had learned more during that period of organization and during the period of the strike than they'd ever learned in their life before. In fact, some of them, we were even teaching them some basic words in reading and writing and things like that. In fact, one young fellow told me that he had always wanted to learn how to read and write, he says, but he was too embarrassed, and his wife had a much better education than she had, than he had. And he said he just felt silly having his wife teach him things like that, that ordinarily he would have known. So he asked me if I would teach him some reading and writing, and of course, the short period of time we were there and all the activities that were going on, there wasn't much chance to actually do much teaching, but I was staying at their house during this period when I couldn't be seen on the street, so we did do a little bit of work then. Of course, actually, just the discussions and so on raised their educational level a great deal.
I suppose there were many of them.
I think, if I remember correctly, there was one member of the executive board. He was the secretary. Was the only one that could read and write. Hmm. And when they signed anything, they had to sign with an X with it. I hadn't lived through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just doesn't seem possible that, especially in a state that's always, well, of course it wasn't in the state of Minnesota, but you more or less consider Minnesota and Wisconsin on more or less of a level, and they were supposed to be progressive states, and to have such conditions existing up there for years, it just doesn't seem possible.
The bridge is falling down, falling down. When the bridge is falling down, my fair lady, build it up with sticks and stones, sticks and stones. Build it up with sticks and stones, my fair lady.
Good.
Oh my darling, oh my darling, oh my darling Clementine, you are lost and gone forever, dreadful sorry, Clementine.
Did you get a
what?
Again, sorry, go ahead.
16 times, what do you get? And another day older. Deep branded, St. Peter and Tacoma, so I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
You know the verse?
Run the place together, you know, him and his brothers.
Maybe he's got copies of it.
I don't doubt it. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he had copies. The FBI was going to raid the house, so we took anything that they could use as any kind of evidence,
yeah,
okay. And took it down and burned it up.
Martha?
We practiced some songs to sing on the picket line. That was our main objective in organizing the auxiliary. Of course, they did help organize in the commissary and feeding,
mm-hmm.
and so on. But before they could actually get a tight-knit organization, we had left by then, and of course then everybody drifting away and everything, so it didn't materialize unless they did something after I left. But we did learn some of the songs, such as Hold the Fort and different union songs that it does a great deal to pep up a picket line and so on, because, you know, if you're on a picket line, there's no activity going on, so, you know, they'll drift away, but if there's something, even singing and so on going on, you'll find that the spirit is much higher. There was this woman that I mentioned before that had been hurt down there, and I had helped her up to the strike headquarters. The night before, her and her husband had stayed with me because of these threats that were going around and so on. And the next morning, they had their pajamas rolled up in a newspaper, and they were quite an elderly couple, and they only had a coupe. And we drove down from where I was living down to the picket line. So when we got in and out of the car both, of course, they needed, you know, to hang on to things as they were getting in and out, and I was carrying this bundle. So it came out in the trials in court afterwards that I was down on the picket line with a gun wrapped up in a newspaper.
Oh, there were trials. We didn't
oh, yes, yes, there was trials. We had attorneys in from Duluth.
What was the trials about?
Oh, I don't remember what charges were placed against them, but I know Harry was...
The ones they were arrested and
yeah,
it
was the entire leadership of the union, and of course many of the rank-and-file pickups. By the way, there was one lumberjack killed during that strike, although the autopsy said that... Okay. The autopsy said that he had died from a blood clot on the brain that would have occurred under any excitement. But actually what happened was that some of these goons had taken this old fellow, this real old fellow, and shoved him into a culvert, head first, down into a culvert. And he was dead when they found him. But we had our own doctor come in when they performed the autopsy. And they said that he would have died under any circumstances where there was any undue excitement, so there was no chance of prosecuting him for it. It must have been after that that he was beaten up, because he came down during the trials. In fact, as I understand it, of course, I wasn't at the trials at all because of the warrants that were out. But as I understand, he really made monkeys out of the attorneys up there.
He was the attorney for the
union. Yeah, and he got them all released. But for instance, Harry, they arrested him three times in 2 days. He got out onto the courthouse steps, and they had another warrant there for something else, and they did that three times. So he didn't get out.
Triple jeopardy.
Yeah.
But was he tried? Was he given a trial?
They were all tried, but they were released. I mean, they none of them served any time.
Mm-hmm. That must have been amazing. They had a jury?
I don't think so. I think it was just the judge.
But the judge must have been accompanying.
Well, of course, they
would be sitting on the bench in a company town.
It was in the county courthouse where the trials were held. It wasn't there in the town. And of course, the county prosecutor was the one that prosecuted the case.
But they're usually company men, those guys. You know, they wouldn't get elected if they or put on the benches if they didn't.
Well, as I said, I don't know too much about those trials. It was just what I had heard afterwards.
It was after that that Hank was beaten up.
Yes, it must have been, because I remember him being at the trials there. But it was the same, vigilantes, what they were. It was the same vigilante leader that beat him. Mm-hmm. Since there, too, after the arrest had been made, I was staying at this house, and I was sleeping upstairs, and there was the bed was right by the window. And I'd look out the window, and I could see headlights of cars circling around and around and around. Of course, this was a very small town. I mean, it was just a matter of a few hundred people there. But these vigilantes patrolled the town there for a long time afterwards. Just waiting, you know, to try and, you know, find somebody alone or something like that. In fact, one night, it was after Harry had been released, it wasn't safe to go back where we'd been living or anything. So there was a couple of kids that built a shack out there in the woods. And, they used it more or less for playhouse or something like that, and we went out there and stayed in that. And that night too, we could see these headlights going around out there in the woods. So they must have had some idea that we were around there someplace, you know, mm-hmm. and probably had looked in all the logical places. So they were circling around there in the woods, all over, looking for us. Isn't that night, we slept with a gun under our pillow.
Isn't that?
I remember when I was a little kid. When we lived out in Robbinsdale, I can remember one night, of course at that time I didn't know what they were, excepting that I knew instinctively that they were something bad. But we were driving along the highway between Robbinsdale and Minneapolis, and up in a grove of trees, there was all these robed figures up there, and they were burning the cross. And that was, of course, over 30 years ago. That was over 30 years ago, but I can still remember it just as if I'd seen it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I think the Klan, during that period, was pretty active up here. Mm-hmm. You know, the paper would come out sometimes at 5 o'clock at night before we could get it from the printers. And we wanted, of course, to get it mailed out. We had a very large mailing list besides the copies that were sold on the streets and shop gates and everything like that. So we naturally tried to get them out, you know, as soon as possible. So I used to work till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning mailing those. And I'd have the wrappers all addressed and all ready to go, so that when the printer gave us the signal that they were ready, all I'd have to do was roll them up, you know, and get them down to the post office. So, of course, nothing happened that one night in particular, but I worked that night until 2 o'clock in the morning, all alone in the office. It was up on Hennepin. The next morning, when I opened up the office, there was glass from one end of that place to the other. The desk was covered with it. The desk that I was working on was just a layer of great big sheets of glass where they'd thrown rocks through the window.
Ooh, okay.
And I thought afterwards that it was a very foolish thing to do, sit up there all alone, because they could just as well have walked in that front door and smashed the place up from the inside.
This was after you'd gone, or that they'd
It was after I left. Mm-hmm. But I didn't work alone up there anymore after that at night.
Who did it?
Well, they had more than one instance of that. Of course, there was notes tied around the rocks, you know, get out of town, you'd be carried out feet first, and all that sort of thing. But they broke into the office one other night. Some mobs, I suppose, they were some of the organized fascists that are around here. And they took, that night, they took the typewriter keys and twisted them around each other, and they smashed up the mimeograph machine, and they tore papers, you know, the things that were in the desks, they just tore them and threw them all over the office. And of course there was threatening notes left that night too.
Nothing was done by the police, right?
Oh no, and not only that, but the office was right on Hennepin Avenue. The hinges were taken off from the doors on the street. See, it was upstairs where the office was, but the hinges were taken off from the door down on the street.
Is that right?
I don't think we even called the police as far as that goes, because there wouldn't be any point to it. That was during a period where there was several strikes going on, and the situation was slightly warm.
Yeah.
I think at that time there was the oil strike and the scrap iron strike, and there was the there was about three of them. I think there was an auto used car salesman also had a strike around that time. And during that period too, we had to carry. I mean, we couldn't leave anything in the office. And I thought afterwards how foolish it was. I'd go out of that office at night, you know, with all these records under my arm, down the street, go down to strike headquarters of all places with these records and things.
All alone.
All alone. And it didn't bother me a bit. I used to, when they had the Finnish Hall and so on, you know, up in Glenwood mm-hmm. there, I used to traipse back and forth from the office way up there, you know. Thought nothing of it.
You were never attacked?
No, I wasn't. Even during all the fights that I was in and everything, I never did get beaten or anything like that. Of course, I did have some bullets was pretty close to me, and I got tear gas several times.
Is that in Minneapolis?
At the Strutware strike, I was standing. Well, of course, there was all the pickets were out there, not in a line, but they were all, you know, just standing around. And the police started firing, and I swear he must have had his gun right up my back, because I could just feel that bullet whiz up my back like that.
From below?
Uh-huh. I don't know what position he was in or I was in, but I know I felt the air, you know, going up
they
my back.
They were firing bullets into the air.
Oh, yes, uh-huh. Of course, I suppose actually what he was doing was firing up in the air to try to disperse the pickets. That was another struggle that was, I think, very important. And of course, it was a very militant strike. There was a lot of women involved in that strike, too, by the way. And there was a couple of instances where the police escorted the scabs out of the plant all the way downtown. You know where Strutware is, down on about 12th Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And the pickets, of course, marched along in the sidewalks while the scabs, escorted by the police, walked down the middle of the street, just like a great big parade. And when they got down to the loop, they escorted them right into the department stores, mainly into Dayton's, where the police lined up on the side, and all the scabs went right in the middle into the store. But, of course, there were several people that got a few black eyes after they got in the store, because there was some of them that recognized them after they got
in the
store.
What were they going to do with them?
With
in
what?
In the store, the scabs. I mean,
well, they took them into the store so that they could scatter out in the crowds and not be recognized, you see.
Oh, I see. They were dispersing them, I see.
Yeah.
These are mostly women. Both
there
the
was,
scabs and the pickets.
Yeah, there was a lot of women on both sides of the struggle there.
The owner was a woman, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that strike was won, and they got, wages in the hosiery industry were very, very low.
Who led that strike? Was that led by the...
That was the local leaders in the plant itself. James Tibbetts was one of the main leaders of it. He was the president of the union.
Well, I think he went to the ILG or the garment workers.
No, it was the hosiery workers union.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're in another group now, but at that time they were. The hosiery workers.
Yeah, there was a lot of
scrap iron, and the oil workers, and the used car salesmen. All those three strikes were going on at once. And the Citizens Alliance, of course, was the leading force. I think they started in mostly during the truck driver strike is when they organized. And of course, all these other strikes followed that in a row. And then the next day, they used the armored cars again at the courthouse where the unemployed had a demonstration. But the armored cars, they were supposed to be so invincible, you know. But they had some of those turned over. And but it was really like a nightmare when you stop to think of these armored cars. They were just circling the blocks as fast as they could go, with these guns sticking out the windows, just mowing people down, just shooting into the crowd. They didn't know who they were shooting. In fact, the two that were killed were young boys that had just stopped there, you know, out of curiosity. They weren't strikers or anything. The two that the bishop were killed. Yeah. Of course, at that time there was, I don't remember, 50 or 60 or something like that were shot besides the two that were killed.
Oh, that was a terrible.
Yeah, it went on until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning with these armored cars going around and around and around.
But you say there was 50 or 60 wounded?
Yeah.
The one that they didn't kill more, isn't it?
Well, it is the way they were shooting in there, and of course the air was just blue with tear gas, because they had the not only the shotguns or whatever kind of guns it is the police used, but they also had the tear gas guns, and they shot those out just like they would shoot a regular gun. But you couldn't hardly see because the tear gas was so thick out there.
That all happened in one period, wasn't it? I mean, right in 6 months' time of each other, that Iron Ornamental strike and the... Was that before or after the truck drivers?
Oh, I think that was after.
Was that the truck
drivers? That was one of the first, the truck driver strike, I think, was one of the first that...
I'll have to get the chronological order of...
Well, that's the trouble with the my thinking on the thing. I mean, one incident will lead to another, but I don't know which one came first.
Well, you could just go through the papers, newspapers, and get a pretty good picture, you know, of the order of events. I'll have to do that then.
Selling it, we went up on either I think it was Broadway. Selling copies of United Action the next day after the shooting had taken place at the Flower City. And there was one amusing thing, it really wasn't amusing, but just to show you, I know that they had called every police officer, no matter where they were, if they were off duty or on vacation or anything else, they called every officer was on duty that night. And when we were out selling the paper the next night, we talked to a couple of policemen that were on the street, you know. And of course they had big headlines in the paper about the brutality of the police. And every policeman that you talked to, they weren't on duty that night. There wasn't a single policeman in Minneapolis that would admit that he was at the Flower City. In fact, you didn't see very many policemen around.
At that period, the policemen were in bad repute. Was that?
Well, there had been.
Oh, he had paws. He was a huge monster, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was captain of the police force at that time.
Well, they had to put him off too. I mean, the cops of that
were pretty scarce around there for quite a long time after that. You couldn't hardly get directions on where to go around in the city.
Calm down, calm down, from your eyes, furry tower.
Put your hands down. Jane, have you got a new baby sister?
Yes.
What's her name?
Denise.
What?
Denise.
Denise? Oh, what does she do? What does she do? Does she walk? Does she talk? Does she read books? Tell what she does. Do you rock her?
Yes.
What do you sing to her when you rock?
It's just falling down, falling down.
You don't sing that
down
to the baby, do you?
Yes.
Do you?
You sing Rockabye Baby.
Oh, Rockabye Baby, you haven't seen. Sing that.
Rockabye Baby, in the treetop, when the wind blows the cradle will rock, and down will come baby, cradle and all.
You know where that song was written? Go ahead.
Oh, my darling.